It's lovely to be here this morning. It's lovely to have the opportunity to share with you. Some of you are maybe looking and thinking, good grief, where has she been? We haven't seen her for a while. Just to tell you, I've actually been around doing stuff for the Church of Scotland. So I've been engaging with some stuff with the Church of Scotland, which has meant I've had to be elsewhere on a Sunday morning. And that's actually going to continue over the next couple of months. So this is the only Sunday in October that I'm actually going to be able to be here. So it's like I felt like it was like for one Sunday only. But I will be around. I haven't left. I will be around. So I've been doing some stuff with them, and I'm sure you'll get to hear about that as time goes on. I think it's always really interesting when we've got a preaching rota set up and we've got passages put into the preaching rota that we're preaching on. So I knew it was Ruth 1 that we were going to look at. I knew that weeks and weeks ago because we've been following the lectionary here, and the lectionary has set passages for each week. And I always think, I love it when that happens. I hate to be left to my own devices when I'm speaking on a Sunday morning. I much prefer somebody to say, there it is, will you speak about that? Because you know something? God sometimes knows. God always knows what it is we actually need to hear on any particular given day. And so I decided when I looked at Ruth 1, well, if you know me at all, you know that I don't like to follow the traditional route in any way, shape or form in anything that I do. And so if I'm preaching on Ruth, you would have thought, yeah, she's going to preach on Ruth. I'm not going to preach on Ruth this morning, because Ruth 1 really for me spoke to me about Naomi. It didn't speak to me about Ruth. And so although we're going to touch on Ruth and who Ruth was, I want to talk about Naomi this morning. And the title for this morning, the title that I came up with was, what do you do when your world falls apart? Because that's really what happened to Naomi. What do you do when your world falls apart? Now, I knew that this was the passage, and I've been mulling this over for weeks. But I want you to hear the context that I'm bringing you this today. So for the last week, I've spent part of every day in the last week sitting at the bedside of a friend of mine who's in intensive care and whose life has hung in the balance this week. And I thought it was one of those crazy things where this passage is the passage I knew I was preaching on Sunday morning, and I had lots of this prepared. And as I've sat at the hospital this week, I've heard God nudge me saying, so you live in it as well. And that's something that's really interesting, isn't it? That sometimes we can talk about it in our heads and sometimes it comes out our mouth, but actually it's not till we're faced with the reality of living it that actually the word of God becomes something that's very deep and entrenched in us. And I've been thinking a lot about that this week. So let's read together Ruth chapter 1. Are we going to manage to get... Yep. Perfect. I'm going to try and turn round and read it. You know that any of you who know me know I'm not very good at reading the passage because I tend to read what I think should be there rather than the words that are there. So I'm going to read the big words on the screen because that helps me to be able to see it. In the days when the judges ruled in Israel, a severe famine came upon the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, taking his wife and his two sons with him. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife was Naomi. Their two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. And when they reached Moab, they settled there. Then Elimelech died, and Naomi was left with her two sons. The two sons married Moabite women. One married a woman named Orpah, and the other a woman named Ruth. But about 10 years later, both Mahlon and Chilion died. This left Naomi alone without her two sons or her husband. Then Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had blessed his people in Judah by giving them good crops again. So Naomi and her daughters-in-law got ready to leave Moab to return to her homeland. With her two daughters-in-law, she set out from the place where she had been living, and they took the road that would lead them back to Judah. But on the way, Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back to your mother's homes, and may the Lord reward you for your kindness to your husbands and to me. May the Lord bless you with the security of another marriage." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they all broke down and wept. "No," they said, "we want to go with you to your people." But Naomi replied, "Why should you go with me? Can I still give birth to other sons who could grow up to be your husbands?" No, my daughters, return to your parents' homes, for I am too old to marry again. And even if it were possible and I were to get married tonight and bear sons, then what? Would you wait for them to grow up and refuse to marry someone else? No, of course not, my daughters. Things are far more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord himself has raised his fist against me. And again they wept together. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung tightly to Naomi. Look, Naomi said to her, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. You should do the same. But Ruth replied, don't ask me to leave you and turn back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord punish me severely if I allow anything but death to separate us. When Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she said nothing more. So the two of them continued on their journey. When they came to Bethlehem, the entire town was excited by their arrival. Is it really Naomi? The woman asked. Don't call me Naomi, she responded. Instead, call me Mara, for the Almighty has made life very bitter for me. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me home empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has caused me to suffer and the Almighty has sent such a tragedy upon me? Amen. You know, you don't have to look very far when you start to read the news or start to look on the news websites. You don't have to look very far before you see people whose lives have suddenly been torn apart. I had a wee look on the BBC website this morning, and here's a couple of headlines. The top headline is Diplomat's Wife Devastated by Harry Dunn's Death. That's the reference to the American diplomat who has gone back to the States after having the road accident where this 19-year-old was killed in that road accident. And I was thinking about that. That's loads of people's lives that have just fallen apart. So you've got the falling apart of the lives of the family of the guy that was killed. You've got actually got the life of the diplomat that's now fallen to pieces because of what's happened. You don't have to look very far in our world today before you see the consequences when something happens and then somebody's life falls apart. And that's really what's happened in this passage. It happens twice in the passage, actually. So if we kind of set the scene for where we're going this morning, Naomi and Elimelech lived in Judah. They lived in Bethlehem. And in Bethlehem, there was plenty for a long time. There was plenty and there was plenty to eat. They were well off. They lived a really good life. But then there was a famine. So there was no food. The food dried up and things were really hard. And it's interesting that we're told that they were Ephrathites. Ephrath was the name that was the ancient name for Bethlehem. So that was the name that the Canaanites gave to Bethlehem. And then when the Jews came along, they renamed it Bethlehem. So Bethlehem's the Jewish name, and Ephrathim is the old Canaanite name. But it's interesting when you look at the names and you look at what the names mean. So Bethlehem actually means house of bread. It's in the name. The place was a place that there was supposed to be plenty. And when you look at what Ephrath means, it means fruitful. So this place that they lived in was supposed to be a place of plenty, a place that was really fruitful. It was, in fact, the land that God had called them into, that he'd said he would be with them and he would give them everything that they needed. And so Bethlehem's name had started to not mean house of bread anymore because there was no food. There was a famine in the land and things were really, really difficult. The interesting thing is that this is the land that these people had been called to live in. Remember when Moses leads them out of slavery and they cross the Jordan and they're looking at the promised land? This is the land that God led them into. It's the land that was supposed to be flowing with milk and honey. That started me thinking about a question. What do you do when where you are doesn't live up to its name? So what do you do when you've gone somewhere or got involved with something that you've got involved with or gone to with great gusto, because actually this is where the Lord's called you to be and this is where you want to be and it's going to be great, and then it doesn't live up to its name? And you see, what Naomi and her husband did was when the land didn't live up to its name, they looked for somewhere else to go. And the interesting thing is that the Lord had promised all along that he would look after them, but when the going got tough, they actually up sticks and they moved to somewhere that looked better. So Naomi and Elimelech pack up and they go to Moab, they go somewhere else. The interesting thing about going to Moab is that it was actually the place that God had said not to go. So God had said, don't go there, you know, stay over here because actually this is where I am and this is where it's going to be okay. And in the promise that that was going to be okay over there, somehow things started to look as if they weren't lining up with what God had said. And Naomi and Elimelech go on a journey across the border into Moab where there was food. Life in Moab was life in a foreign country. They were moving from everything they knew to a place that they didn't know anymore. They didn't know people. It was a completely foreign country. It would, I suppose, be like us moving from here to a Middle Eastern country where the culture and everything else is different. That's what it was like for Naomi and Elimelech and then moving to Moab. Eventually they have their sons and their sons marry Moabite women. That was something that God had told the Israelites not to do. So they'd gone from the place that God had brought, had taken them to. They moved to somewhere else where it looked much more comfortable. I wonder how you justify to yourself when you get involved in the things that you know that God has told you are a bad idea. I wonder how Naomi and Elimelech managed to justify that to themselves. That here they were almost throwing out in one fell swoop all the stuff that God had suggested them to them to do. And you see, the thing that struck me about this is, so they move, so God has said to them, settle in the promised land, I'm going to be there, it might be tough, but I'll be there and I'll make sure you're okay. And so it doesn't go so well there, and what they see doesn't line up with what God has said to them. And so they think, right, we're not going to stay here anymore because it looks, God must have made a mistake. It looks better over here, so I'm going to take my family, I'm going to go over here, I'm going to settle over here and it'll be okay. And so that's the kind of first move that they make away from where God had said they should be. And that started me thinking, see, when we make one move into a place that we think, oh, well, it'll be okay, it's just one thing, how quickly it leads to then something else, and then something else, and then something else. So they have the move into Moab that then becomes having two sons marrying Moabite women, which is what God said don't do, because actually that's not a great idea. And so I started to think about these folks who had gone from one place to another, having their life fallen apart, thinking that they're rebuilding a life again. And then all of a sudden, life falls apart again for Naomi. So when everything falls to pieces, Elimelech dies, and then her two sons die as well. And there's Naomi and the two daughters-in-law who are left. And then what does Naomi do? She hears that there's food in Judah again, that the famine's over, there's food there, and so Naomi decides to go back to what she knew and where she knew. It must have been really hard for Naomi to be in Moab, in a place that was foreign to her. The culture was foreign, everything about the place was foreign, her family was all back in Judah, and it wasn't like she had a phone that she could just text them back and forward and stay in touch with them. You know, it was days away in terms of being able to walk. So it must have been really difficult, and it's really understandable that Naomi wants to go back to where she was. So when life falls to pieces, Naomi decides to go back to what was familiar to her. Then in verse 13, she blames God. She says, things are far more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord himself has raised his fist against me. It's awful easy, isn't it? When things are falling apart round about us, it's awful easy to look for somebody to blame. And often the one that we blame first is God. I was over the summertime, this is nothing like Naomi's issues here or the issues in terms of stuff that many of us are facing, but over the summertime we went on holiday and there had been a whole pile of things, you know those things where you get all these wee things that happen and you think to yourself, look God, you're going to just give me a break. Every time I turn round there seems to be something else. And so I was champing at the bit to get to my holiday. You know, you're seeing the finish line up there and you're thinking, right, I'm going and it'll all stop and I'll go away and I'll forget it all and it'll be great. And so we went on holiday and we were flying on holiday, and we were on the plane, we got off the plane, we got to where we were staying. I got up the next morning, went to get my laptop. No laptop. The laptop's still on the plane. And I was raging. I was absolutely raging. I thought, God, you have got to be kidding me on. Surely to goodness, you saw me put that laptop under the seat. Could you not have given me some kind of nudge on the way off the plane to tell me that the laptop was there? I was absolutely raging. And I had texted a friend. My friend that I had texted is a lovely, so I do invitation really well. My friend does challenge really well. It's a really good combination. And I text my friend and I'd been saying to her, I'm trying not to be raging with God. And back came this text from her that just said, two lines, I'm really sure it's not God's fault. And at that point, I wanted to take the phone and I wanted to lob it somewhere that I would never, ever see it again. But do you know, sometimes when stuff happens, we're just looking for somebody to blame, aren't we? And actually, there is a real tension in, well, so what, God? You could have intervened. Why did you not intervene? And that is a big live question. And I'm not telling you I've got any answers for that, because I don't have. It's one of those questions that I just hold in tension. I don't know. And it's on my list of questions that when I get to heaven, I'm going to work through with them. And I'm sure that if it's important by that time, there'll be an answer for it. So Naomi rages at God. She's bitter because actually she sees that God has raised his fist against her. Then in verse 12, she says to her daughters, no, you've not to come with me. You go back to your parents. She actually starts to isolate herself. Ever done that? Ever been in a place where you just feel rubbish? And when people come to offer their help, you're just like, no, I'm absolutely fine. It's not a problem. I'm just getting on with things. You just go and get on with your stuff. And we isolate sometimes and we push people away. And that's what we see Naomi doing. You see, Naomi was dealing with loss. That's what was going on for her. There had been a massive change for her, massive amounts of things that were different for her, and she was dealing with loss. And you know, we deal with loss every day. It doesn't need to be a big, massive thing like Naomi's loss, where she lost her husband and then lost her two sons. It doesn't need to be, although it might be. But we deal with loss every day. Every single change that happens in our life is a tiny loss, because something's different, something has shifted, and something has moved. It's not the same anymore. And the challenge for us is, how do we deal with loss? Even good changes bring loss. Even positive changes bring loss, because there's something that we were familiar with that's not there anymore. So how do we deal with loss? Well, here's a big list of ways that we deal with loss. Sometimes we go into denial. Ever done that? Oh, no, it's not happening. It won't happen. And in actual fact, if I just do this, 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 and this, then it'll pop out the other end and it'll not be the same. So we deny it's not happened, and we deny how we feel. I'm absolutely fine. It's not an issue for me. The Lord knows, and we're going to move on and it'll be fine. And so we deny there's actually any emotional involvement with it. We minimize. We make it out to be less serious or having less of an impact. Oh, it doesn't really matter, you know, it's just one of those things. And we minimize and we trivialize it. Sometimes we blame, a bit like Naomi did. Sometimes we blame God. Sometimes we blame other people. Well, if he had just, you know, if... So my thing with the laptop on the plane, we were last on the plane. Everybody had brought tons of luggage, so all of the overhead lockers were full. So my case was away down the front, and I was worried because my laptop was in my case, or I wouldn't have taken it out of the case. And so it was like, see if people wouldn't just bring as much luggage on the plane, then my laptop would have been absolutely fine. But we do, we blame, don't we? We find somebody that we can throw the blame at. Sometimes we over-spiritualize. Ever done that? So the Lord must have a plan. He must know what he's doing. And now, I'm not knocking that. That's absolutely true. But in the midst of it, it really hurts. So it doesn't really hurt me. I'm okay with it. I'm absolutely fine because I'm trusting in the Lord and his promises will work out. And that's true. But actually, it still hurts. And when we over-spiritualize it and make it something, make that thing bigger than actually being able to acknowledge the humanity in it, then sometimes that causes difficulties for us. Sometimes we blame ourselves. if we just, and I've done a bit of that this week. I've thought, gosh, if I had just noticed that my friend wasn't great, if I had just noticed. And so you can ruminate over it. If I had just done this, if I had just been quicker, if I had just whatever. And we can blame ourselves. Sometimes we rationalize it. Well, you know, it's for the best. Because if this happened or this happened, it's actually for the best. And so we start to rationalize it. Sometimes we distract ourselves. So it's like, I'm not going to think about that because Strictly's on the television and I'm going to get myself absorbed in that and then I'll not need to think about anything else. Or that great Netflix series that's on the television, I'm going to totally immerse myself in that. Or maybe I'll play Xbox for 2 or 3 hours because that'll take me out of it and I really need to get this game finished or whatever. And so we distract ourselves so we don't have to sit with the feelings that the loss brings. Sometimes we become hostile, and I think Naomi probably did a bit of that. Sometimes we become a bit hostile and we start to get really nippy with people. We start to get angry with people. We start to throw things around the place. And we know that there's something going on inside us, but it's actually hard to be able to express that to anybody else. And sometimes we medicate. Don't we? Sometimes we medicate. Sometimes we actually take stuff that makes us feel better. There are some nights when I've gone home, when I've had a particularly bad day, that I've thought to myself, man, I could murder a glass of wine. Because I know if I have a glass of wine, it'll take the edge off things. Can I tell you that those are the nights that I don't ever have a glass of wine? Because I've recognised that what I'm doing is medicating my pain. And what God asks me to do is sit with the pain and with him, to actually allow myself to feel it and to process it. But we medicate pain, and then sometimes we point fingers at people who have learned all their life how to medicate their pain. And that really is just what folks are doing. We medicate with anything. We medicate with alcohol. We medicate with drugs. We medicate with shopping. We medicate with going to the gym and, you know, having crazy workouts every night. We medicate with work. We medicate with TV. We medicate with chocolate. Anything that is about dulling pain for us is about medicating. That's what we're doing. Doesn't matter what it is. So since we're in church, and since it's a Sunday, maybe we need to ask the question, what would Jesus do? Remember those bracelets that you used to get? So how did Jesus deal with loss? Well, when we start to read about, particularly we've been singing about it this morning, when we start to read about what happened to Jesus and how Jesus knew that he was going to be crucified. And so when we land in Matthew's gospel, we see Jesus called it what it was. So in the Garden of Gethsemane, he says to his friends, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. That's fairly strong. Ever said to MD, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death? Maybe we wouldn't use that language, but actually, that's fairly strong. Jesus was telling it how it was. He was hurting, and he was telling his friends that he was hurting. Then Jesus asks for what he needs. He says to them, stay here and keep watch with me. So Jesus is able to express what he feels. He's able to express the pain that's there, and he asks for help. Of course, when we read on, we read on that his friends weren't really very good at delivering on that help and they fell asleep. That wasn't so good. But actually, Jesus is able to ask for what he needs. Sometimes when people tell us how it is for them, we don't really know what to do with that. Sometimes when people say to us, I'm really hurting, we don't know what to do with it. So again, you know, in terms of where I've been in this past year for me has really been marked with loss. There's been lots of losses, and one of the big losses, if you don't know, my dad died on the 31st of January, and that was, my mum had died 2 years previously, and I had been looking after my dad for 2 years. And so in that period of time, I was determined that I was actually going to try and live what I teach, and I was going to try and live and be real with people. So when people said, how are you? I was going to say, actually, I'm feeling rubbish. I'm having a really sad day today. Do you know what was fascinating for me in that was watching how people reacted to it? See, when somebody says to you, I'm really hurting, please don't say to them, please don't start the next sentence that you say to them with, oh, well, at least. Please don't do that. Let's just commit as a family here not to do that to each other or to anybody else. That's not empathy. That's actually sympathy. That's like saying, oh, for goodness sake, well, it's okay. And we don't need that when we hurt. You know, so it's like somebody coming up to Naomi and saying, oh, well, at least you've got two daughters-in-law. The woman's lost everything. Oh, well, at least. And, you know, I think we do that because we find it hard to sit with people in their pain. We don't know what to say. We don't know what to do. And something in us rises up and wants to make it better. And can I say to you that sometimes you can't make it better? Sometimes it's not possible. Sometimes all we need to do and all we want, and I'm sure if you've ever been there, all you want is for somebody to sit with you and say, I don't know what to say to you, but I'm okay to sit with you, and I'm really glad that you told me. Sometimes that's the only thing that we can say to people, but actually sometimes it's the most valuable thing we can say. So I said that we were landing on Naomi this morning. I want to mention Ruth, because Ruth's obviously the action hero in the whole book here, and it's named after, and it would be wrong to read a chapter about Ruth and not mention Ruth. So what can we learn from Ruth's response to Naomi if we're talking about how we respond to pain? Verse 16 says, Ruth replied, don't ask me to leave you and turn back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Ruth is really persistent. Naomi has shoved Ruth away, has said, don't be ridiculous, you're going back, go back, go back with your sister-in-law. And Ruth is absolutely tenaciously determined that she's not going to leave Naomi. Ruth is really persistent, and sometimes we need to be persistent with each other, especially when we're hurting. Sometimes we need to not take no for an answer. I don't mean that we trample all over somebody's feelings and somebody's wishes. I'm not suggesting that. But sometimes we need to be persistent about making sure that somebody's all right. Verse 14, the text says that Ruth clings to Naomi. That word cling is really interesting. The Hebrew word that's used for that word cling is used elsewhere. And look at what it means. It means profound love, or it's translated as profound love and unshakable commitment. That's where what it's translated as in other places. Ruth was persistent. She was unshakable in her commitment to Naomi. And she had that profound love for her. Ruth was also prepared to give up her own comforts for Naomi. Ruth could have stayed in Moab. She was a Moabite. All her family and her friends and everything, her culture was there. But Ruth, determined to support Naomi, persistent in her love for Naomi, gives up her home comforts to make sure that Naomi's okay. I want to suggest to you that staying with others in their pain sometimes is costly for us. Sometimes it's uncomfortable. And sometimes it takes us to places that we don't really want to go. When we look at Ruth, we see that determination, commitment, and love. But remember too that this is coming from somebody who's also dealing with her own profound loss. Her husband has died. Her brother-in-law has died. Her father-in-law has died. So this is somebody who's dealing with her own stuff as well, but is willing to go out of her way to make sure that Naomi's okay. And I want to ask you the question, what do people see when they look at us here? When we look at Ruth, we see that dogged determination to be there for Naomi. What do people see when they look at our faith community here? Do we go the distance with each other? Orpah went back to where it was comfortable. Ruth stayed with the pain. Do we go the distance with each other? Are we committed to going the distance with one another? Because if we're not committed to going the distance with each other in here, it's going to be really hard to go the distance with anybody out there. If we're not able to do it in our family, then it's awfully hard to do it outside of that. When people look at us, do they see people who cling to each other? Do they see that profound love and unshakable commitment? Is that what people see when they look at us? When folk look in here on a Sunday morning, do they look and they think, man, what profound love and unshakable commitment they've got for one another? Do they? When people look at us, do they say, I want to be part of that community? Look how they love each other. When was the last time that you heard somebody outside of a church say that about a church? Say about a church, I really want to be, I have to be part of that, because can you see how they love each other? Can you see how they support each other? Folks, the world's watching. The community's watching. And there's something about how we stay together and how we're like Ruth to somebody else's Naomi. Maybe today God's calling you to be a Ruth. Maybe today God's calling you to go that extra mile with somebody. Maybe he's calling you to get back in touch with that person that you thought, oh man, I wonder how they are. Or maybe actually you're in the place of Naomi today. And you need somebody to just come alongside you. You need to know that it's okay not to be okay in this place. You need to know that it's okay to hurt, and it's okay to be able to express that you hurt. And we won't always get it right, because sometimes we'll say, oh, at least, sometimes we will, because we won't always get it right. But actually, we're working really hard at being a faith community here who are here for each other, who are profoundly committed to each other and unshakable in our love for each other. And when people see that, then the world will know that we really are his disciples and people are attracted in.